this presentation will attempt to summarize 30 years and 20 minutes.
All right.
It's not possible to prove anything or even explain anything adequately. I'll present a brief history, mention one or two key conclusions from each stage in this history. It started in the 1980s with a system of cognitive styles, developed into a cognitive model, which was then applied to psychology and counseling. Theological principles started to emerge. The thinking behind science was examined, and other social and cognitive theories also examined from a cognitive perspective. This same methodology was then applied to the biblical text, including what is regarded as supernatural or spiritual. We'll now look in more detail. There we go. Okay, the basic premise of cognitive styles is that people can be categorized into different styles of thinking. Romans 12 opens by talking about the mind, as shown by the commonly quoted phrase, be transformed by the renewing of the mind, but few people go further. The next verses describe what this means. Verses 6 to 8, there's a list of 7 different gifts, and the context implies that these gifts are related to the mind. This connection was first made between this and cognitive styles in the 1970s. It's still taught today in a religious context. Okay. My brother, Lane Friesen, went beyond this religious mindset by using Romans 12 spiritual gifts to analyze 200 biographies. This resulted in 7 lists of traits, which my brother put into book form. Yeah.
There you go.
As we examine these lists of traits, we realize each list could be summarized in a few core traits. Going further, I found that these core traits map onto brain regions. For instance, I'm a perceiver. Oh, perceiver sounds better. Perceiver person who thinks naturally in terms of connections, objects, maps. This is a function of the right parietal cortex. In the 1980s, one could come up with a general map between cognitive styles and brain regions. Far more is now known about the brain, and this new evidence is consistent in detail, and I've got a 70-page appendix in my book that looks at the neurology. One of the byproducts of escaping a religious mindset was that churches and religious organizations lost interest in our work. Yes. Okay. The cognitive model can be summarized by a simple diagram, which I refer to as the diagram of mental symmetry. Many details have been added since then, but this still summarizes the essence. So, the 7 names of the cognitive styles are in the middle of the diagram. The lines and arrows indicate how they are connected. Teacher and server, circled there, use analytical or left hemisphere processing. Your information, and then the mercy and perceiver use right hemisphere associative processing. Information can be given an emotional label or else a label of confidence or certainty. Exhorter and contributor emphasize processing that occurs within the basal ganglia. Exhorter provides drive related to dopamine, and contributor chooses and optimizes. A lot of recent research being done on that, optimizing happening in the basal ganglia. Finally, the facilitator adjusts. This kind of thinking can be seen in the thalamus. Normally, one would take a few hours to discuss this. We'll limit ourselves to 2 key points. First, the 7 names can refer either to people or to parts of the mind. For instance, one can talk about server person, or one can talk about server thought. Server thought is present in all people because everyone has the same kind of brain. But the server person appears to be conscious in server thought, while the other 6 modules function subconsciously under the surface. Similarly, other cognitive styles. Second, there are 2 different kinds of emotion, and this has been popping up in a number of talks. Mercy thought applies emotional labels to concrete experiences, which are triggered associatively by the experiences of normal life, normal emotion. There's also an abstract emotion associated with teacher thought. Teacher thought feels good when many items fit together in a simple way. For example, coming up with a simple explanation, general theory, symmetry, those sorts of things, mathematics, those sorts of things. Even though teacher emotion is ubiquitous, it is seldom discussed, and I've been amazed how many times it has come up this weekend. The word shalom means wholeness. Mental symmetry makes it possible to define shalom more precisely as all seven modules working together. Each person will naturally develop and use the module that is conscious, while naturally ignoring modules that are outside of conscious awareness. If one examines how each cognitive style uses conscious thought, one can assemble a composite picture of how a whole mind would function. In other words, how does the perceiver person use perceiver thought, how does the servant person use the observer thought, etc., etc. This composite picture of mental wholeness naturally turns is into ought, because one's assembling observations of how minds do work in order to determine how the mind could work. And Piaget's stages of cognitive development are appropriate. Going further, each cognitive style struggles with a predictable set of issues. For instance, the perceiver person, my type, finds it difficult to deal with injustice and struggles with anger. This knowledge is very useful for counseling. We will now turn our attention from analyzing people to looking at how the mind forms images of people. The mercy person thinks naturally in terms of people, which implies that everyone uses mercy thought to form images of people. A mental concept of person is a collection of emotional experiences associated with that person, which I refer to as a mental network. It's possible to form mental concepts of people who do not exist. For instance, even though Santa Claus does not exist, we all have a collection of emotional memories associated with the imaginary person of Santa Claus, which predicts how Santa Claus would behave. A general theory in teacher thought is also a package of emotional memories. And when a person continues to work with some general theory, it will also turn into a mental network. Mercy thought, which thinks in terms of people, will naturally interpret a theory as a kind of imaginary person. But a theory, such as the theory of gravity, does not reside in any specific place. So, mercy thought will naturally interpret a universal theory as a universal imaginary person who lives within words outside of space and time. In other words, a concept of God will emerge naturally when a sufficiently general theory applies to personal identity. Whether God exists or not, whether this kind of God exists or not. And that concept of God will use emotional pressure to guide thinking and behavior. So you can postpone the question of the existence of God while studying how a concept of God in an intelligent manner. Because a concept of God emerges when a universal theory affects personal identity, one can view a concept of God from either this personal mercy perspective or from the theoretical teacher perspective. This distinction can be seen in two quotes by the physicist Paul Dirac. In 1927, Paul Dirac defined the concept of God as someone transcendent who affects personal human experiences within mercy thought, and concluded that science has eliminated the need for such a concept of God. Moving forward, in 1963, Paul Dirac redefined the concept of God as a personalization of the universal teacher order of the natural universe in which we live, and science leads naturally to this concept of God. The relationship between these two concepts of God has been investigated by experiments carried out by the cognitive science religion. Teacher thought uses words to come up with theories. One can learn how teacher thought initially forms theories about words by observing how children come up with rules of grammar. Linguists have found that children will begin by overgeneralizing, saying things like, I go to the store. These overgeneralized theories will then be restricted by exceptions to the rule. Saying this in terms of cognitive modules, teacher thought comes up with a general theory, and then perceiver thought uses facts to limit the domain of that theory. Overgeneralization feels good as theory, because one is making a simple statement that applies to many situations. Facts are the enemy of overgeneralization because they stop teacher thought from making sweeping statements. I suggest that the concept of God emerges when a sufficiently general theory applies to personal identity. The simplest theory is to overgeneralize. Overgeneralizing is different than generalizing. To overgeneralize that all is one. This is a single sweeping statement that covers everything. For instance, notice how this poster overgeneralizes all religions into a single statement about light. The easiest way to apply something is through identification. One can see this in the behavior of a young child who will pretend to be a fireman, a nurse, or an airplane. If overgeneralization and identification are both common in children, this tells us that these mental strategies emerge naturally when the mind is starting to develop. Mysticism combines overgeneralization in teacher thought with identification in mercy thought, as illustrated by the joke of the Buddha ordering a hot dog and saying, "Make me one with everything." Mystical experiences are often analyzed using technical language, but the mystic will stress that analyzing mysticism is actually a hindrance to achieving mysticism. I mentioned that facts are the enemy of overgeneralization. Similarly, mysticism typically dismisses facts or minimizes facts about physical reality, either by stating the world is an illusion or by stating that God is an incomprehensible mystery who transcends rational thought. So there's one way to perform a concept of God. We'll turn our attention now from emotional thought to technical thought. Our study of cognitive styles showed that the contributor person naturally uses one of two different kinds of technical thought. Abstract technical thought uses words to work with theories guided by precise definitions as illustrated by logic and math. Concrete technical thought uses actions to pursue some bottom line guided by principles of cause and effect as illustrated by fields such as business or professional sports. One finds these same two kinds of technical thought interacting in science. It's been brought up in a previous talk. On the one hand, one can use abstract math with its symbols and precise definitions to describe the behavior of the natural world. On the other hand, one can also learn about the behavior of the world by using concrete thought to perform experiments that uncover relationships of cause and effect. Science has discovered that these two totally different approaches lead to the same results. Looking at this cognitively, there is an aspect of the universe that's consistent with abstract technical thought, there's an aspect that's consistent with concrete technical thought, and these two are consistent with one another. Turning now to theology, one sees these same two aspects connecting together in incarnation. On the one hand, incarnation is described as the Word who lives with God, similar to the way that the words of math live with the universality of natural law. On the other hand, incarnation is also described as the Word made flesh, who lived with humanity, similar to the way that experimental principles of cause and effect flesh out universal laws of nature. Jesus said several times in the Gospel of John, he only did what he saw the Father do, telling us that these two aspects of incarnation are consistent with one another. Summarizing, one finds the same kind of interaction within the mind, between the two sides of contributor thought, within physical reality, between math and experiment, and within theology, between the divine and human side of incarnation. Going further, the Bible describes incarnation as a sinless person. Similarly, the principle of least action, I discussed earlier, says that every natural process occurs in a manner that is inhumanly perfect. This correspondence between technical thought, science, and incarnation is explored in the book of Natural Cognitive Theology. Emotions interact with technical thought. Thomas Kuhn explored this relationship in his famous work on paradigm shifts. A paradigm is a general theory of teacher thought that satisfies an emotional need. The whole thing is Zecchi paper on mathematical theories and orbital frontal. A scientist needs a paradigm and will only let go of one paradigm if given a better alternative. A scientist will experience negative emotions when a paradigm falls apart and will often respond with emotions such as sarcasm or personal belittling when a paradigm is threatened or questioned. Technical thinking is not emotional, and Kuhn said that scientists spend most of their time using technical thought to solve puzzles within some paradigm. Because technical thought assumes some paradigm, it can't be used to test alternative paradigms. Okay. Instead, I suggest that a paradigm is like a set of glasses. One tests a set of glasses by wearing them and then checking how much one can see and how clearly one can see. Similarly, I suggest one tests a paradigm by wearing it and testing it for scope and clarity. For instance, mysticism has infinite scope because it provides a simple explanation for everything, but it has zero clarity because one cannot add factual details to overgeneralization, but must rather remain at the blurry level of sweeping statements. Testing a paradigm is different than checking facts. Checking facts involves perceived thought, and the primary struggle there is between blind faith and evidence. Testing a paradigm, in contrast, involves teacher thought. If mental symmetry is a good paradigm, it should be possible to use it as a set of glasses. One does this by asking three primary questions. One, what cognitive modules are being used? For instance, a paradigm involves teacher thought. Facts involve perceiver thought. Two, how are these various cognitive modules interacting? For instance, mysticism uses teacher thought at the expense of perceiver thought. It comes up with a universal theory at the expense of facts. Three other common patterns of behavior. For example, both childish grammar and mysticism use the same cognitive mechanism of teacher overgeneralization. Becoming fluent in language is more than just using technical thought to apply rules of grammar and memorize vocabulary, because one is acquiring a new verbal paradigm and learning how to communicate in new social settings. Angelina Van Dyke and I recently examined about 15 different aspects of the TESOL field from a cognitive perspective and presented several papers. The cognitive science of religion examines religion from a cognitive perspective, similar to the approach I've been using, and their experimental findings fit nicely into the theory of mental symmetry. For example, you can use mental symmetry to explain what CSR calls the agency detective. We began by talking about cognitive styles and cognitive modules. Cognitive modules can interact in one of three primary ways. You can see this in both abstract and concrete thought. There are mental networks, they're emotional, they're triggered. There are some examples. Technical thought is rational, it's naturally specialized. A field will enter technical thought by going through some process of official accreditation. That's what usually happens. Normal thought, based on patterns and analogies, as described by Lakoff and Johnson in Metaphors We Live By. The theory of mental symmetry uses primarily these patterns and analogies. In my experience, those who use primarily technical thought will usually respond by saying, I'm using the wrong type of thinking. Whereas those who usually use mental networks will tend to respond with a gut reaction that I'm using the wrong kind of thinking. But I think you have to use this sort of thought if you want to come up with a universal theory. About 3 years ago, I started looking at the Bible using the same methodology, asking the same three questions. That leads to the idea of cognitively natural symbolism. So similar to what Lakoff and Johnson talked about. For example, mercy thought lives in a sea of emotional experiences, which acquires stability as perceiver thought builds solid connections. So you have water as a cognitively natural symbol of mercy thought and rock as a cognitively natural symbol of perceiver thought. So you can do this mapping. I've now applied this methodology to about one-third of the New Testament, going through the original Greek verse by verse, trying to focus on more difficult passages, looked a bit at the Pentateuch as well. I found that the biblical text comes into focus. It seems like at the level of a textbook. when one applies this sort of cognitive methodology. And I got about 1,000 pages of that stuff on the web. Finally, the Bible talks about miracles. We all know miracles violate the materialistic paradigms of science. In contrast, the theory of mental symmetry can be naturally extended through symmetry to include the supernatural and the spiritual. In very brief, living in the natural world resonates with concrete thought. But one can also conceive of a mirror image supernatural realm that would resonate with what we call abstract thought, similar to the relationship between particle and wave in physics. And going further, it appears the spiritual realm can be explained as an external environment that resonates with mental networks. And interesting, the Bible talks about these in different ways. So one can use rational thought to explore the supernatural and the spiritual while postponing the question of whether these actually exist. Thank you.
So we have 10 minutes for questions, and we will vacate this room at 12:35. Thank you so much.
I was thinking about personality types. How does this mental symmetry map onto personality types? Have you explored?
I've looked at a number of schemes. People always keep telling me about new schemes that, okay, I've looked at all of them. The most common one, of course, Myers-Briggs. Basically, you've got thinking versus feeling. You've got the perceiver and the mercy there, where thinking is perceiver without mercy, and feeling is mercy without perceiver. So it's a wall, whereas this is two functioning modules. Similar thinking versus sensing versus intuition. That's server without teacher and teacher without server. So Myers-Briggs is a good description of very common ways that the mind develops in a partial manner. So, and then there are other schemes. We'd have to talk about them one by one, but that's a common one. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question on mystical states.
Yeah.
And how that relates to mental behavior, mental paradigm. Some people would say that the way you recognize it in a mystical state, the way you recognize it, whereas you may be having, if you don't recognize it, is that something happens on the shadow side of your thinking or your behavior.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you use your cases, you may be a teaching person, and suddenly you find yourself being a mercy person because the situation requires that, and God doesn't have anybody else around but you, and so you acquire a sense of empowerment that enables you to be something on the shadow side of your personality.
Okay, you're looking at two things there. First, looking at cognitive, there's intuitive thought, which I haven't talked about, mentioned very briefly there, which is linking this experiential and the theoretical and jumping from one to another. That is a normal form of thought that's often used. That's why I emphasize the mysticism happens when you combine the overgeneralization with the identification. So it's the ultimate form of intuitive thought, but it's intuitive thought is used a lot, and it's a very useful starting point. The other thing is that's spirituality seems to interact with mental networks. That's my hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And so then you can say, okay, I will postpone the question of whether that spirituality actually exists and say, let's look at it at the level of mental networks. We can analyze it cognitively. We can have a rational discussion. And actually, I've tried to distinguish between these two, and I cannot tell where the mental network stops and the spirituality starts, or the other way around. I don't know. Seems to be, it's like this mind-brain thing. You know, where does one stop and the other start? But
could you say we are both always present?
See, again, I don't know exactly. All I know is this allows one to do intelligent study and thinking about it without having to become a card-carrying charismatic.
I see.
Are all these capacities there in every brain, and that some brains are more developed in one area, like you say, perceiver, or like, how do you see the average brain?
Okay, that was the question that I asked about 20 years ago. Hey, everybody's got all seven parts of the brain. Wait, these cognitive styles appear to be different. How do you put those together? Okay. The best answer I could come up with is that it's differing consciousness. That a perceiver person is conscious in the perceiver part of the brain, and they have all parts. And the goal is to get all parts to work, because that's the mental wholeness. And guess what? If I want to know how to get my server part to work, a really good way is to interact with a server person who lives there and knows what it's like. So, but as I've been observing that over the years, it seems to be consistent. Stuff that is totally obvious to me, as obvious as the nose is on my face, other people just of different cognitive styles don't get. But stuff that's totally obvious to them, it just doesn't hit me. It's the other parts, the subconscious, it's like it's a phone line. It phones you up and says, I'm not feeling good, or I'm not working well. And you say, why? And it says, I won't tell you. So now you got to figure it out.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
So certain parts are undeveloped.
They're
not stimulated enough.
Subconscious does not necessarily mean undeveloped. For example, my mother was a mercy person. That is subconscious in my mind. However, due to her upbringing, she determined, made sure that part worked in my mind, even though it's subconscious. And it's interesting, the fact that this idea of cognitive styles is such a recent idea suggests that the culture was sufficiently strong in earlier centuries that people could not individuate and discover who they actually were. Yes?
Normally, the basal ganglia and the thalamus are considered to be active below the level of consciousness, and the lower right hemisphere stuff is as well. So how do you fit that with saying that these different styles represent different types of consciousness? I mean, I don't think anybody's conscious in the thalamus.
I was thinking about that one. Because what I have noticed over the last 20 years with neurological research is that a lot more higher level thought is now being associated with precisely those two regions, the basal ganglia and thalamus. So that used to be the total view, but it's really whether it has been elevated to the level of consciousness yet, I don't know, but it certainly has been elevated to the level from animal responses to intelligent thought. And you certainly see a very strong thing there. In terms of the thalamus, it's the game. If it's not working properly, the person will go. They will lose consciousness. So there's definitely a connection there. All I'm saying is when I look at the... that's the first thing. The first thing is that it's associated a lot more with intelligent thought than it was. The second thing is I look at the structure and behavior and interaction of something like the thalamus. I compare it with the behavior, what I see in the facilitator. I see a mapping. A mapping that includes the details. And so that's where I'm making my it's an intelligent leap, but I see neurology heading in that direction. That's the best answer I can give you.
I wonder if you're using consciousness of it in different manners. Because when you talk about that, it made me think of internal body systems therapy. That would be, it wouldn't be really subconscious. It would be, the analogy would be one part is center stage, the other is all the backstage. So it's not necessarily that they're subconscious in a logical sense, brain mapping. Does that help?
So I don't know the exact answer to that question.
Yeah.
That's the big question that everybody's asking. All I know is, as I've been studying this, it seems that this at least gives you a little bit of a foothold into making some progress in that question.
Yeah, another question, how does this relate to the concept of emotional styles?
Emotional styles.
Davidson's.
Ooh, I'm not familiar with that one. As in different kinds of emotion?
He suggests the concept of emotional styles as a substitute for personality styles.
Okay.
And I can't quite remember the ones he
there. Yeah, yeah.
It's helpful.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that there is a logical, how do I say, an executive side to the brain / mind, and an emotional side, and that the two interact. And I think that's a lot of people are heading in that direction. And this seems to be that's the same thing that this is saying. Some cognitive styles are functioning rational. Emotion is not the opposite of rational. Emotion is a shortcut for rational that is often correct, but not necessarily correct.
That's right. Okay.
One comment. One way of looking at this, I'm a physician, I see a lot of trauma in my ICU, and I can see patients changing, and their parents describe the kids changing, and the adults describe themselves changing after concussion, for example, and it changed their personality as a person.
Yes.
And they react different to emotion, they react different to their cognition, they cannot read a book and understand what the book says, they can read the whole book and then cannot tell you anything. And that sometimes recovers over time. Because another way of looking at it is from the normality to the disease, to come back to the normality. So maybe a different perspective there.
That's why I would agree with that whole thing of the integrated dualism, where I think mind and brain are separate, but they are integrated, they're interacting on a very detailed level so that one suffers when the other suffers.
My pastor of my church, he starts selling fishy schemes in the Caribbean.
Oh.
He used to be
dorsolateral frontal?
Exactly. He injured his frontal lobe in a bicycle. Wow.
Interesting.
Okay. I think we're finished and we can have some